Well, let me add my welcome to Charmaine's. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your lunch break to come and be with us this afternoon. So, has science buried God? Well, in true analytical fashion, that depends which science you're talking about. Geology tends to be better equipped to deal with Earth and rocks and that sort of thing, so it probably has a better chance of burying. Astrophysics doesn't really spend much time on Earth, so probably wouldn't really care about anything burying anything else. But of course, we're not really just talking about different scientific disciplines here. Though many would say that biology is presenting the loudest, if not the biggest challenge to belief in God in the 21st century, it is worth coming back to the whole question of what science we are talking about. Now, this isn't so much to work out whether belief in God is more or less challenged by genetics or optics or botany, but to try and work out the general approach to problems that we sum up with that one word, science. Now, the word does get bandied about pretty carelessly in the media and in our conversation. Often, scientist in a given context just means an expert. Someone with a PhD in something will often get wheeled into the discussion on GMTV to declare their expert opinion on the Large Hadron Collider, if you remember what that was about, or the most recent technological discovery. So the idea that science has buried God tends to arise from this use of scientific opinion. There'll be a discussion about the origins of the universe, or the evolution of organisms by natural selection, and a scientist will be brought in to show scientifically how God just doesn't exist. Science has given us iPods, evolution, reconstructed dinosaurs, string theory, the Met Office, and paracetamol. Add to that list the non-existence of God. Case closed, surely. Or not quite. Just over the next few minutes, it would be great to look in a little more detail at how this conclusion of science burying God is often arrived at. This lunchtime, I don't want to try and convince you conclusively that there is a God. But I would like to ask you to follow the way that science is often applied to the question of God's existence and see, at the end of it, whether he's as buried as many people say he is. So let's first look at what science or the scientific method is actually trying to do. You'll see on your handouts that I've gone for this definition as something which most atheistic scientists would hopefully be happy with. So there on your sheets. Science is the process by which we seek to arrive at the best explanation for what we observe. So once a theory has been proposed, the way it gets proven as a good theory is by explaining more and more things observed by experiment. So the more experiments a theory explains, the closer that theory gets to what's actually happening. That's why scientists' opinions are valued on those TV programs. The stories they tell have been proven again and again to reflect what actually happens. Now, the particular conclusion we're looking at today is the statement, science has buried God. Just to give science the best chance of doing just that, let's see whether this theory explains what we actually see around us. Let's see if the scientific theory that there is no God, or that he's some outdated relic from our primitive past, explains what we see well. You'll see in your quotes, your sheet as well. I've got a quotation from Richard Dawkins. You've got to have Richard Dawkins in a science talk. He summed up this no-God hypothesis really quite nicely here. So, science offers us an explanation of how complexity, the difficult, arose out of simplicity, the easy. The hypothesis of God offers no worthwhile explanation for anything, for it simply postulates what we're trying to explain. That's a pretty strong no-God hypothesis, if you ask me. Now, at this point, I ought to say that the God whose burying we're assessing is the God who speaks through the Bible, and who anyone can meet as they read about Jesus Christ. He's not just the God who's most often in scientific atheist sites. He's also the only God I believe in. Now we've got that straight, let's look at two areas which the no-God hypothesis should explain well and see if there's sufficient evidence for burying everything about God by the end. So first, on your sheets, matter. Now, science, of course, has a lot to say about the material world. So does the God of the Bible. Looking at the history of science, there's one view adopted by many atheist scientists that God was proposed by mankind to explain everything they saw in nature that they couldn't explain any other way. Humans looked at the enormity of the universe, the beauty of a sunset, the complexity of a spider's web, and their own complexity, and concluded that someone had to be behind it. This someone also had to be infinitely more complex and powerful than they were. Now, this view is sometimes called the God of the gaps, you'll see on your handouts. Basically, you propose God for everything you can't explain. Now, this view is often put forward in various forms by Daniel Dennett, a famous atheist writer, and Carl Sagan, the physicist, who is also a convinced atheist. According to this view, as science becomes more and more sophisticated, there are fewer and fewer gaps. God keeps getting smaller and smaller as science gets bigger and bigger until finally God just goes pop and disappears. Now, there's a story about this which has unfortunately been embellished over time that gives a legendary moment where God was finally buried beyond all return. The French mathematician and astronomer Pierre-Simon Laplace allegedly presented his treatise on celestial mechanics, so how the solar system works, to Napoleon. The emperor was sort of sitting on his throne, and as he read through this celestial mechanics thing, or kind of skim read it probably, he observed that it was very elegant and beautiful, but this system for explaining the universe made no reference to its creator, meaning, of course, God. The story goes that Laplace then drew himself up to his full height, probably looking down his nose, and said, in French, of course, and I'm not going to subject you to that, "I had no need of that hypothesis." Meaning, of course, that God just didn't fit in his system. Now, whether or not it's true, this story has certainly been given by atheist scientists as the end point to all that nonsense about God in serious discussions about material evidence. But this view of science getting bigger as God gets smaller doesn't explain what we actually see at least two levels. First, there are a lot of Christian scientists. Francis Collins, one of the leaders of the Human Genome Project, a vast operation to accurately work out every single piece of code in human DNA, is an outspoken Christian. John Lennox is a Christian Oxford mathematician who's debated regularly on science, actually with Richard Dawkins. Dennis Alexander is a molecular biologist and the director of the Faraday Institute in Cambridge. And he's written loads of Christian and science books. Now, of course, this doesn't explain necessarily anything in relation to whether God exists. It doesn't prove anything. All these scientists could be wrong. But it does raise serious questions about the God of the gaps approach to burying God. The trouble with matter as evidence against God, for the second thing, is that it's inconclusive. Whether matter works as evidence in favour of God's existence or against his existence is dependent on where you start. So a committed atheist scientist will accumulate more and more evidence as to why their theory about God not existing is right. But a committed Christian scientist or theist scientist will look at the same evidence and see it as yet more and more reasons to marvel at how wonderful God's creation is. So depending on who you're speaking to, matter builds up or tears down evidence for God's existence. Now, both the no God and the God hypothesis have unresolved puzzles, so I'm not going to try and convince you which you should go for today. But however those problems are tackled by the people who really believe it, their initial assumption about God remains unchallenged. Atheists say matter as evidence buries God, Christians don't. So at this point, matter, as an area for the no-God hypothesis to explain, has run into a problem. For every person who says matter is best explained by no-God, you'll run into another person who says matter is best explained by assuming there's a wonderfully powerful God. And there'll be a huge number of committed scientists who say that science hasn't actually led them in either direction. They're quite comfortably agnostic. In the opinion of many scientists who should know, matter is explained just as well by God existing as by him not existing. So what are we going to say in conclusion? At the very least, God is not buried by looking at the natural world. Whether you're looking at evolution in biology and geology, or the beginnings of the universe with the Big Bang in physics and cosmology. God or no God is a starting point, not an end point. So what about this second area of evidence on our sheets? Morality. Let's see how the no-God hypothesis does at explaining how we handle questions of right and wrong. Now, there are loads of no-God hypotheses on morality, but most begin by assuming that morality is not absolute. There's no ultimate, timeless moral law which everyone agrees to. It just looks like that. Given the right sociological, genetic, environmental, chemical, or psychological factors, a society's conception of what's right and wrong can end up pretty much anywhere. One carbon-based organism's opinion is as valid as any other's. Now, Richard Dawkins, again, has written a lot on this subject, so I'll borrow some of his terms here. He's proposed the concept of memes as the building blocks of culture, just as genes are the building blocks of biology. A meme is a little bit of cultural data, like a joke, or a basic belief, or someone yelling Fenton as a dog runs across a field in Richmond, if anyone saw that YouTube video. So in the same way that genes are the code for making a person, memes are the code for making culture, including morality. Morality will be chosen unconsciously by consensus. All the conflicting demands of individual selfish gene replicators, that's you and me, folks, need to be balanced against the needs of the community as a whole. Whichever moral laws do this best will emerge as what most people think is right and wrong. This is, of course, where the no-God hypothesis starts to become fairly unscientific. No one lives as if this hypothesis is true. No one. I'd like you to think for a moment about the worst crime you can imagine. Now think for a moment about arriving in a country where everyone did that crime all the time without batting an eyelid. It's still wrong, isn't it? We all differ as to which things strike us as absolutely for all time for everyone being beyond the pale, but the things we think are wrong are not just wrong for us. If we really feel them that strongly, they're not just wrong for us. They're wrong for everyone. Now, the no-God hypothesis does try to explain this. There is evidence that certain cultural traits, or memes, actually mean human beings have a better chance of survival. Richard Dawkins would give altruism as an example of this. Doesn't make sense in evolution, surely survival of the fittest. But actually, as a meme, altruism means that being kind to members of our own family increases the likelihood of our section of the gene pool surviving to the next generation. Equally, being kind to survival competitors, so people outside your family, also suggests that one day they'll be kind to us, or that our reputation will be boosted. And that then also means that we're more likely to survive and pass on our genes or memes. We feel things as right and wrong, as strongly as we do, thinking about that crime you were thinking of, not because God has created a universe where what he says goes, but because our genes have evolved to tell us what's right and wrong. But even that way of looking at the no-God hypothesis doesn't explain what we actually feel and see when it comes to morality. Remember, that's what we're doing. We're trying to see whether the no-God hypothesis explains all the things we're looking at. Contrary to what many atheist scientists would have us believe, these questions and debates are actually not new. If you look with me on the sheets, C.S. Lewis wrote that quotation in Mere Christianity which was first published in 1952. So read with me. Human beings all over the earth have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way and cannot really get rid of it. Secondly, they know that they do not in fact behave in that way. They know the law of nature, they break it. The no-God hypothesis at one level or another has to appeal to social consensus to produce morality. We believe things are right and wrong because that's what works best in society, or that's what worked best to reproduce our genes. But if this is true, then most members of that society won't just agree with that morality. They'll keep it. Why shouldn't they? These two things should go together. If we all believe we all ought to behave in a certain way, we should all behave in that way most of the time. What could stop us? Let's look at an example to try and illustrate this. Adultery is not a good thing to do by most standards of morality. If anything's been agreed on as a bad thing to do by everyone's standards, then that's it. But of course, adulterous relationships keep on happening. Surely we'll either accept universally that adultery just happens, it's good for our genes and good for community, and therefore everyone will do it without batting an eyelid. Or we'll realise that it's bad for community and bad for spreading our genes, and we'll stop doing it. Why would evolution select for mass guilt? Either we have a system everyone agrees to and obeys, or we have no system with everyone doing whatever they want. But I'd like to suggest this lunchtime that the persistence of a middle ground between these two extremes presents evidence that the no-God hypothesis just can't bury. We all know nobody's perfect, but if there's no God, there's no reason why. Christianity does have an explanation. The God of the Bible created each of us in his image, able to live as he commanded us. But we chose to go our own way and reject his kind and generous rule. We all now still have a vague understanding of what he says is right. Trying to live without him is hard and painful. But every time we see again that his way is right, we instead reinforce our original rejection of him. We persistently decide that we know better than God does. But he doesn't stop being God, and his commands don't stop being good. And we all know it. Each new attempt to strike out on our own ends in failure, because the relationship we were originally made for has been broken. That's why we feel guilty. Now, this doesn't mean that belief in a Christian God is automatically better than saying God has been buried by science. But at this point, I'd urge you to consider what Jesus has to say into this situation of our continual rejection of God's commands. Also, is it worth reconsidering whether science has really dealt God such a decisive blow at all? Refusing to listen to what Jesus has to say about matter, God, and morality on scientific grounds just doesn't add up. Now, there are all sorts of things you can do to see just how much the God hypothesis explains. Why not ask the person who brought you why they believe in Jesus? Why not read about his life and look into what he said for yourself? You'll see on the handouts there's a web address at the bottom. That site, www.christianityexplored.org, is specifically designed for anyone who has questions about Christian faith. I realise I've only scratched the surface of some really huge topics this lunchtime. Please don't leave here without looking at all these questions further, whether via that site or by speaking to the colleague you came with. Many people here can testify that Jesus gives us a better explanation of our world than we could ever dream up. Why not see what you think? I'd stake my life on it being worth your while.